This is Drum Kun. I want to talk about Taylor Swift. I want to talk about the unknown history of her dealings with obscure corporations. In fact, what prompted me to make this podcast about Taylor Swift is an Instagram post that she made on the 23rd of 2020. I'm not a fan of Taylor Swift. I couldn't possibly name any one of her songs, but I was just reading the news about the music industry, and I came across this information that, you know, it did sort of make me think, because I'm making music, you know, I've started doing so professionally this year, and you know, I own all my copyrights to my music. In fact, I want to give those to my son, and I don't want to, you know, ever give up my copyrights to some entity. And of course, I sympathize with musicians who don't own their own masters, they don't own their own copyright. For all my music, you know, my music, my handpan music, I specialize in a very special instrument. It would be sad, I think, if some corporation was exploiting my music, you know, at the expense of me or my family. You know, I don't make those millions like Taylor Swift is making, but I can understand, as a creator, as a person making her creativity, she obviously feels robbed by these corporations. And of course, I don't know the full details of you know, the Scooter Braun affair, but what I did manage to do, though, is to find out a part of history about Taylor Swift that appears to me to have been swept under the rug. But I think it's important to dig this history, which I have done, and it's an exclusive on this podcast that I'm releasing this information. I think many artists, many would-be artists can learn. You know, I'm doing this for, you might say, for educational purposes, you know, that people might learn not to be taken advantage of by, you know, sometimes people want to be famous, they want to be artists, you know, and there are many of these corporations and people who promise you the sky and everything in it, but only to take advantage of you down the line. And many people don't pay attention to these details. And of course, in the case of Taylor Swift, I mean, like what I'm going to be divulging, which is an exclusive here on this podcast, I can assure you that this history of Taylor Swift, you've never heard it in all the biographies and all these informations. And I think it's in the public interest to do this. And if this information does reach to Taylor Swift, it's because I actually sympathize with her current situation in regards to her copyrights, of course. And I find it incredible that even artists like Kanye West, even though I'm not a fan of his music, I'm not a fan of Taylor Swift, I listen to handpan music, period. My handpan music, nothing else. Even though, as I said, I'm not a fan of Kanye West, but he's been tweeting and posting his musical contracts, which I have, and I'm studying, I'm reading them online, and he's saying that he wants his children to own his masters. You know, I would have thought an artist as successful as we are told is Kanye West, as a musician, owned his own masters, but apparently this is not the case with many musicians, and I think that's a bit strange. You know, as I said, I don't come from the musical background. You know, music was taken from me as a kid. And this is something I've had to sort of, with God's grace, you know, to get to discover this side of me. And I've made a documentary. You know, you can go to my links on this podcast and you will find, you know, this documentary. You can watch it. I tell my story, you know. But this today, I want to talk about Taylor Swift. And the headline is Taylor Swift Leaked Exclusive. So, first of all, what prompted me to make this podcast is an Instagram post she made on the 23rd of April on 2020, and it reads in part, I quote here, she says, "It looks to me like Scooter Braun and his financial backers, 23 Capital, Alex Soros, and the Soros family and the Carlyle Group have seen the latest balance sheets and realized that paying $330 million for my music wasn't exactly a wise choice and they need money," close quote. She also wrote in the post, I quote, "In my opinion, just then, in my opinion, dot, 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 just another case of shameless greed in the time of coronavirus. So tasteless, but very transparent," close quote. I think this is an amazing statement. I mean, these are amazing statements that she is making. I'm not, as I said, I don't know Scooter Braun as a person. I don't know Alex Soros or the Soros family or the Carlyle Group. I'm not speaking on their behalf. I'm not speaking on the behalf of Taylor. I'm just making my own, investigative sort of journalism. I have a background actually doing a bit of journalism stuff. But so sit back and listen to this gold mine of information about Taylor Swift that it appears to have been conveniently whitewashed into the dustbins of history, but I think this is part of music history, and for a person of her stature, this information I think should be out in the public and should be studied, you know, because I think it becomes part of music history. Now, before the Scooter Braun affair that is well known in the media, with Taylor Swift speaking about it in her post and social media, Taylor was, in fact, and this is very important now, I really want you to pay attention, and this is my history, and I can back this up with information. Now, Taylor Swift is, in fact, a prodigy of Atlantic Talent Management. Okay, let me repeat this, and please remember this name. We will come back to this name, Atlantic Talent Management. Now, this is part of Taylor's history of dealing with obscure companies. Now, today, if you Google their website for Atlantic Talent Management, it is nothing but a kids' furniture store. You know, their website at the time was called AtlanticKids.com. So it's strange that, you know, when you go back now, you say, what? It appears to be selling kids' furniture, something like that. But this is where I think to understand Taylor Swift and her dealings with corporations, these obscure corporations, we have to look at this information. So this is the key detail in my investigation. The first capture of her website, taylorswift.com, the first capture on the internet, you know, thanks to Alexa Crawls and the Wayback Machine. I had to go back. I mean, you can't find this information on her own website today, so I had to go back. And so the very first capture on the internet about Taylor Swift, her website, the date is June 8, 2002. This is a very key date if you're going to go and find historical information about Taylor Swift, June 8, 2002, we have the first capture of a website. And this information reveals a gold mine of information. It reveals the following key information. And I just want to comment on something before I start these revelations. Whatever you put online, you know that it's not going to disappear, you know. Maybe if you put it online before 2000 or in the 90s, maybe. But I think post-2000, it might be very complicated. So whatever you put out online, you have to be sure that this information is being saved, because, you know, there are initiatives out there to save the internet and preserve it, you know, as a historical document. So, and I think that's a good thing. Now, the first capture of Taylor Swift's website was June 8, 2002. As I said, this is a key date. And it reveals the following key information. Number one, Taylor was 12 years old and a sixth grade student, okay? So she was a 12-year-old and a sixth grade student by June 8, 2002. But if you go on a Wikipedia, apparently it says that she's been active in music from 2003 onwards. There's very, very little information about her doing music and the music business, the showbiz, you know, like in that period of June 2002. Seems to be you don't find very much even on a Wikipedia. It just says she's been active from 2003. It just starts talking a lot about Taylor when she moved to Nashville, Tennessee. Doesn't really go into depth with these years, you know, of 2002. So according to the information that I found out, she was 12 years old and a sixth grade student. So obviously she was under the legal age. She obviously had her parents as her guardians. In terms of contracts, that is significant in the sense that she would have needed perhaps her parents to sign off on certain documents, certain information, because she would have been under their age. But already, you know, she was in the show business. So she lived near Reading, Pennsylvania, with her parents. Not in Reading, but near Reading. This is very important. She lived near Reading, Pennsylvania, with her parents and younger brother. She was being managed, and this is very important. I've already mentioned this name. She was being managed, and managed is a very important word, by Atlantic Talent Management. Now, this is an important name. We have to remember this. There was also another young artist who was being managed by the same corporation. Her name, she didn't become a big star like Taylor Swift, but her name is Angela D'Angelo. And I think Taylor Swift is aware of who Angela Marie D'Angelo is. They are, I think, about the same age. So, you know, these are two young ladies who are being managed by the same talent management called Atlantic Talent Management. Two different outcomes in their careers. I cannot say that Atlantic Management is responsible. Atlantic Talent Management is responsible for the success of Taylor Swift. But I think maybe these ladies were vulnerable to maybe false promises, and therefore it's a form of manipulation based on false promises and false advertising. And we're going to get to look into that in depth. Now, just a recap. As of June 8, 2002, the first capture of her website, according to Alexa Crowell's The Wayback Machine, apart from the fact that she was 12 years old, she was in the sixth grade, she lived near Reading, Pennsylvania, with her parents and younger brother, and as I already mentioned, she was being managed by Atlantic Talent Management. Back then, Taylor was wowing crowds by performing renditions of the American national anthem at basketball games. I mean, and another important point, she even had demo CDs. So she was performing quite a bit, as I've already mentioned, at, you know, singing the national anthem. In fact, her highlights, her vocal highlights, as at, this is now a little fast forward, I'm going a little fast forward here, into 2003, February 16, some of her highlights, her vocal highlights, which was, you know, where the first one, national anthem singer for the Reading Royals professional hockey team. That was October, November 2002 and February, March 2003. So she was singing the national anthem for this hockey team. And I've already mentioned, I think she was also doing, you know, basketball games. So she was singing the national anthem. We know that this is customary in America when they have, you know, football games or baseball, basketball, whatever. There's usually that moment when people sing the national anthem. And I think she took that opportunity to display her vocal abilities. And obviously, this was a ready audience because, you know, these people were there to watch hockey. They would have been there to watch basketball. So I think this Atlantic Talent Management, this agency, was obviously targeting to, you know, those games, those hockey games, basketball games, to bring to the audience, you know, to their awareness that there was this 12-year-old sixth grade student. Obviously, come on, imagine, this is a hockey game or basketball game. I mean, one of the basketball games, one of the audience attending, you know, was Jay-Z, and Jay-Z wasn't even talking to Taylor Swift. He wasn't interested. He was just there for a game, but they love to put it on her website that, oh, in the audience was also Jay-Z when she sang the national anthem. You know what I mean? She was like not a celebrity at all, you know, but of course she would have charmed the crowd, being a 12-year-old sixth grade student singing the national anthem before this ginormous audience. Another of her vocal highlights in that period was you know, opening act, WIOV Radio Music Fest. There were 17,000 in attendance. That was October 2002. So she was the opening act. I don't know when they say opening act, whether she was singing a national anthem or what act she was opening. But, oh, yeah, it says here. So she was the opening act, and then it says here, and this was October 2002. So this is fast forward a little bit from the first capture of information that we get on Taylor Swift, which is June 8, 2002. So fast forward from June, you know, June, July, August, September, October, about 4 months later, you can see here, under the management of that company that was called Atlantic Talent Management, she was now, you know, you can see the history here. She was a national anthem singer for the hockey team, the Reading Royals professional hockey team, you know, in around October, November 2002, you know, to February, March 2003. But also in October 2002, this talent agency obviously had somehow opened the doors for her to be an opening act. Because as an opening act, one gets an opportunity, obviously, to open for big names and to sort of warm, you know, stage warmer, as we call it. Somebody who is warming up the stage, you know, before the big names come on board. But of course, this was important to make a name for her. And the audience says here it was 17,000 attending. I mean, you can't buy that much publicity. So obviously, being an opening act was very important to Taylor Swift. And so she opened for Diamond Rio, Tammy Cochran, Trace Adkins, and Daryl Woolley. Another one of her vocal highlights, she was a featured soloist in Merrill Lynch management team, flown to California to sing for Mayor Rudy Giuliani, guess what, in October 2002. So she's already being put in the circuit of, you know, this you can see this is Merrill Lynch management team, this is some, I don't know, some financial corporation. And she's being flown, as you can see, she's 12 years old. So obviously, if she's being flown, you know, this, she would have been under the age. So she would have obviously needed some, you know, help, assistance, help with the transportation to those events. And also assistance with obtaining representation, and you know, maybe even wardrobe. She would have needed help with a lot of things. You know, she would have been given recommendations on her wardrobe. You can imagine, right? You start imagining a 12-year-old girl is being told you're going to perform. There's gonna be Rudy Giuliani, is gonna be there, and you know. So, and again, what's interesting, Giuliani is the mayor of California here. And okay, I don't know if he's the mayor of California, but they just say Mayor Rudy Giuliani. This was highlighted in black, meaning this was very, very important. So, the, you know, like the national anthem singing for the Reading Royals professional hockey team, that was highlighted as an opening act, as I'm mentioning, for, you know, that was highlighted. For the WIOV Radio Music Festival, 17,000, that was highlighted. As in, like, this is key events. And Mayor Rudy Giuliani's name is also highlighted in black, meaning that was a very key, important. I think maybe Taylor Swift remembers that Merrill Lynch management team event and being flown to California. So you can imagine a 12-year-old being flown anywhere. Yeah, I don't know if she was flown anywhere before this, but this appears to me to have been one of those first times that she's sort of experiencing what this possible future entertainment lifestyle is all about. And obviously she's going to sing for Mayor Rudy Giuliani. She would have, you know, been coached on how to dress, how to talk, how to walk. And I think there is a lot of strange things that, you know, that might, I don't want to say there were strange things, but I'm simply saying a 12-year-old girl performing for the mayor, that can be a lot of pressure on a young person. And obviously, you know, these agents have a lot of monopoly in terms of they can decide A, B, C, D. Of course, the parents can say yes, can say no. I don't know if the parents attended or not. But these are key things in Taylor's history that we don't even find on Facebook. You know, on Wikipedia. You don't find the Merrill Lynch management team event where she was a featured soloist and flown to California to sing for Mayor Rudy Giuliani. You know, you don't find the thing that she was a national anthem singer for hockey, you know, teams, for a hockey team, or she was singing at a basketball event. Nothing about this is being mentioned at all. Now, another key vocal highlight is that she was the opening act for the Charlie Daniels Band at the Pat Garrett Amphitheater. That was in September 2002. So you can see there's a lot of things going on here under this the management of that Atlantic Talent Management, which apparently today, if you go on the website, it's like a furniture store or something for kids with the bedroom and clothes. It's very strange. But anyway, another highlight here, she was a featured soloist at a U.S. Army Field Band and Soldiers Chorus with the Reading Symphony. That was in September 2002. So you can see that her gigs at this time is like hockey, sports, this music festival, you know, she's an opening act. Then she's a featured soloist. There's Merrill Lynch. This is a big corporation. Mayor Giuliani. You know, these are personalities. And the Charlie, she's an opening act. So opening act, she did that quite a bit for several names. And now she's a featured soloist at the U.S. Army Field Band and Soldiers Chorus with the Reading Symphony. And as I said, she lived near Reading, so maybe, I don't know, the connection here. But again, another featured highlight is that she did the National Anthem U.S. Open Tennis Tour Tournament in Flushing Meadows, New York, August 2002. So you can see the national anthem, it appears like she was the go-to young lady to do the national anthem. And this was a U.S. Open tennis tournament, so obviously there's a lot of sports events, you know, and some corporate events, but I can see a lot of sports here. She also did a one-hour show at Nobles Grove Amusement Park for WYGL Radio headline performer in June 2002. Actually, I think this is very key information about Taylor Swift, and I think I should maybe dig a little deeper into that, because it's quite interesting that you know, as I mentioned, that as early as 2002, she was, you know, she was this 12-year-old, sixth grade student. She lived near Reading, Pennsylvania, with her parents and her brother. She was, as I said, being managed by Atlantic Talent Management, so this corporation had a key role in her career. And as I mentioned, she was performing to crowds at sports events like the American, you know, the basketball games, the hockey team, and she even had several demo CDs by that particular time. And the website, there was nothing fancy to it. I mean, it was just flanked by these sort of, you know, these cowboy boots, like they're kind of like red and kind of white. And nothing fancy at all. It was just a very simple website, you know, on their first capture. But of course, what's interesting is as you move forward a little bit, you know, to that period of, you know, late 2002, you begin to see certain events, certain things happening in her career. She's appearing before Mayor Giuliani. She's singing. You know, I have to repeat this so you really get it, because I want you to get this this important history, because I think this is part of music history, you know. Now, remember that Atlantic Talent Management is at this stage managing her. And the company was also managing, and please remember this, the company, which is Atlantic Talent Management, was also managing another 12-year-old named Angela Marie D'Angelo, normally just called Angela D'Angelo. Now, this is important. I'm mentioning this name because these two were very, very important, you know, individuals, you know, to that talent. You know, Taylor Swift, they were pushing Taylor Swift and pushing D'Angelo, Angela D'Angelo, as I've mentioned, and Taylor Swift, you know. And all this was before Taylor's debut album even, you know, became available, you know. I mean, it would take from 2002, 3, 4, 5, 6, 4 more years for her debut album to actually, you know, it was called Taylor Swift to debut. But these are key events in that she's a performer. She's going to all these events, as you've seen. She's performing for, you know, these big crowds. She's opening act, you know, and she's traveling, and she's only 12 years old. So you can imagine. And as I've mentioned, the talent, the agency, which was Atlantic Talent Management, was also managing Angela Marie D'Angelo. Now, that agency operated in Pennsylvania, which explains maybe that's where she got recruited by these people, or where she came into the know-how about these people, because it was a small company. That's what it said on the website. And it operated in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, New York. So maybe that's why, you know, they had a network or whatever. But anyway, my archaeological digital dig, thanks to Alexa Crowles and the Wayback Machine, reveals that, and I quote, I'm quoting here, and this was on the website of Atlantic Talent Management, a website today which is now apparently, it's like a furniture thing for kids or something, very strange. But it read, and this is important, so please pay attention. It reads, Atlantic, I quote, Atlantic Talent Management is a small company that gets big results. The big here is written in capital letters. So Atlantic Talent Management in capital letters is a small company that gets big capital letters results by giving you and your child the attention you deserve. Exclamation mark. Personalized attention is the key to our success. Atlantic Talent Management helps children realize their potential in the entertainment industry as well as life. Close quote. So obviously, if I analyze this correctly, the statement I just read, you know, was this, there's a key selling point here to Tyler's family to sign her to this agency, you know, since she was only 12 at the time, and this agency was like specializing because they're targeting your child, so they're specifically saying that, you know, if they're saying Atlantic Talent Management is a small company that gets big results by giving you and your child the attention you deserve. So the child here is the focus, and the personalized attention is, of course, the parents, they're helping with, you know, making it big and getting big results in the what? Entertainment industry as well as in life. Now, these promises to get big results for Taylor in the show business through personalized attention, I'm not sure these promises were fulfilled, for instance, for the other young lady, D'Angelo. As I said, I have the facts that I have here. So what I don't have, I can only, you know, speculate, but I don't want to go into speculation. So I'm going to go with what I have here. And my own analysis is that Taylor Swift and her family, you know, probably had a lot of dealings with this type of corporations. And we know that in the entertainment business, that there are many false, you know, marketing people who want to make, they know that maybe people want to make their daughter or son or whatever a star. And maybe some parents are just, you know, they just want their kid to become a star and famous. And maybe they don't do enough due diligence on, you know, the contracts they sign with these agencies or with these corporations. Also enough due diligence on the backgrounds of some of the individuals in these corporations. Maybe this would explain how a character like Scooter Braun ended up owning Tyler's important catalog, because you would have thought that, you know, her family would have been paying attention to that information, you know, to her copyright stuff. And I don't know if she had a lawyer or anybody looking at it, but it's very strange that this catalog was bought legally by Scooter Braun, and is an important catalog of her music, and you would have thought she would have been in control of this catalog. So to me, anyway, this reveals there's a lot of shoddy obscure, maybe even scams, you know, promising big things and, you know, focusing people on the attention and the big stage, the glitz and the glamour of it all. But maybe behind the scenes, it's a fertile ground for, you know, copyright manipulation, like what we are seeing with Taylor Swift today. You know, I don't know what role this talent agency or similar agencies maybe she would have signed with after dealing with that one. Had, you know, I don't know what role they played in failing to get her to secure her copyrights. You know, this should be, I think, to any agency, is to tell the artist, you know, make sure that you don't sell out your copyrights. You understand what I'm saying? But if that's not the first thing they're telling you, like here on the website of that agency, you know, they wrote also here, this was their marketing statement, is your son or daughter, I'm quoting here, quote, open quote, is your son or daughter born to entertain, and this is in quotes, question mark, born to entertain. Can you imagine? Is your child just as talented as those kids in the movies, television, and B-Way, meaning for Broadway? Question mark. Are you ready to move beyond community theater with your child? Question mark. Is your child getting the attention he or she deserves from your current manager? Question mark. So email, then they say webmaster at atlantickids.com, close quote. Now today, if you Google atlantickids.com, nothing but a furniture store. I've already told you that. But you can see here they were targeting people who have kids, and these kids are talented, obviously. I mean, if she was singing the national anthem before these audiences and wowing crowds and whatever, I mean, she obviously is a talented vocalist, you know, and musician. And at 12 years old, I don't think she understood show business, and I don't even think her parents necessarily understood show business. You know, if they were just normal parents, maybe they realize they want to support their child into this industry, into, you know, I don't know if, you know, maybe people trust people too much. But anyway, Atlantic Services, talent management, also included career management, counseling, headshot, wardrobe recommendations, song selection, vocal and acting coaching, choosing auditions, transportation to from auditions, on location monitoring and callback coaching, assistance with obtaining representation from an agent. I mean, that's a lot of things. And as a young person who is 12, coming under the, you have to imagine how much of a childhood would have been sacrificed to, you know, get this career going. Because, you know, no more 12-year-old girls would have been, I don't know, playing, you know, doing, you know, normal things that 12-year-old girls do. But yeah, she was performing at Merrill Lynch events for Mia, Rudy Giuliani, for these hockey games and all these events and opening acts. You know, I think it's a very, it's difficult. I mean, if you've never gone through that sort of thing, and I pray to God my kid will not go through such things, that it's like hard to understand. You know, it may be easy, I guess, to judge Taylor Swift, and I don't want to judge Taylor Swift. I'm not judging anyone, I'm not judging Scooter Braun or those I'm just saying my opinion, because I've never met these people, but I'm just studying the documentation. You know, I like to dig for information that is obscure. I have a talent for that, actually. And try to bring it out, because I think this is part of music history. So why is it, and this is a question, that nothing about this company that seems to have played a very key and pivotal role in Taylor's early, you know, career is not mentioned in a biography, you know, like on Wikipedia? You know, if why is it that the website now is a furniture store? I don't even know if it's a real store, but there's a furniture, there's like a bed and blankets, and it's very strange, nothing about talent management. I mean, that company was founded in 2000, and by 2002, they were already having, you know, Taylor Swift under their belt. And as I mentioned, two of the people they were managing was Taylor Swift and the young lady that I've mentioned, the D'Angelo. And so one begs the question, you know, what happened? And who were these people? And why are they not necessarily mentioned in a biography? And we know that this corporation, Atlantic Talent Management, was founded in 2000 for the purpose of providing professional caring service to talented child performers and their families who are seeking success in the business of entertainment. And I think this is very telling, the statement. When people are seeking success in the business of entertainment, I think there are many temptations, many manipulations, many falsehoods, many false promises, many, you know, I think this entertainment business, you know, when people hear that, you know, people sell their souls to try and make it in that business because it's very competitive and very complex. And, you know, if one is 12 years old, I don't think they fully grasp the impact of maybe some decision, some contract. Maybe, you know, their parents sign on their behalf, or she may have signed. Maybe, you know, maybe when she was 12 or 13 or 14 or 15 or 16, I don't know, you know, would she have necessarily understood the long-term impacts of such contractual agreements? Or would she have been locked into some contract that maybe when she became fully aware a few years later, she would have realized that, oh, this was not something. If she had known what this really spelled, she would have made a different decision. So I think people have to be careful, you know, not just people with young kids who want to become famous, or, you know, who have a talent, and there's this so-called business of entertainment. I mean, I think it's a cutthroat, you know. I'm an independent musician, you know. I make my handpan music. I distribute it through an independent distributor that is not very known or whatever. You know, I don't get so much money. And I think I've gotten my first payout from... Well, it wasn't a payout. I still can't get the payout because the minimum payout is $10. So, but however, my first streaming revenue, largely from Spotify, was $1. And I think this month I got like $5. So now I have like $6 and maybe 24 cents American dollars. And the payout minimum is $10, you know. So it's like peanuts, you know. If you told Taylor Swift that I make $6, you know, but I own all my copyrights, you know. And maybe she has made $300 million, but she doesn't own her copyrights, you know. I don't know what some people would choose, but, you know, for me, I'm, you know, I wouldn't sell my music to some corporation to, you know, manipulate it. And, you know, I think it's like it's an extension of me, my expression, you know. And I talk about my musical journey in my documentary, you know, which you can watch on my links. And it's very personal to me, so... I mean, would I sell my copyrights even if somebody came with a bag of cash and said to me, here, I'll give you 300 million or whatever, you know, 100 million or even 3 million or whatever, thousands of millions. I mean, would I take that bag of money and sell my copyrights to the highest bidder? Or, I mean, I mean, I don't have a lot of money, you know. I'm comfortable, you know. I don't think money has ever made me happy, you know what I mean? By God's grace, you know, I've had what I need, you know. I mean, sometimes I get things secondhand, and, you know, that's fine, you know. I mean, I'm not starving. I have a roof over my head. My kid is happy. You know, I'm happy with my lady. You know, we're a small family. We have a simple life, and, you know, there's a lot of love, we laugh a lot, and I make my music and I want to give it to my kid, you know, as an expression. Like this, you know, there's also a lot of message in that that I want him to think about, and you know, so I mean, I talked to one guy, I remember, a friend of mine, and we were talking about, there's a family, you know, that I know somewhere, and their father passed away and he left a very big property, you know, land, big house and everything, worth millions of dollars. And you know, the siblings were fighting. Some don't want it sold, they want to maintain the property, some they want the money, and there's a big conflict there, you know. And then I was saying to my friend, you know, I was explaining this thing to him, that this guy came to me and he was telling me about this conflict with his sister, about money and the house, you know, he doesn't want it sold, and you know, all these things. And the guy was like, oh, me, I have insurance, you know, I think if I die, my kids will get some of my insurance. And then I was thinking, you know, I'm being frank, I don't have insurance, I don't know what what insurance means, to be quite frank with you. You know, I'm from Africa, man, who has insurance? I mean, maybe the African elites, but no more everyday citizens, you know, I don't know, I don't have, let me just put it this way, I do not have life insurance, all this so-called insurance. And anyway, so he was like, yeah, I got this insurance, if I die, I think my kids will get $1 million or something like that. Like, okay. Then I said, but you know, if I asked myself, you know, if I wanted to leave something to my kids, I have one kid, actually, my son, to my son, what would I actually want to leave them, you know? I mean, I remember at one point I was like, yeah, I want to do this numismatics. I like numismatics because it's collecting coins. I'm coming back to Taylor Swift, okay? I collect coins, you know, for historical purposes. I learn a lot when I studied the history of coinage and what was the messaging. And there's a lot, believe me. I've even written a book about that. But it's a book I've written for my son. You know, there's only one copy of that book. So you, even if you had $1 million, you cannot buy it. I just wanted to preserve that information for my kid. Anyway, and then I thought, I wanted at one time to buy these gold and silver coins, you know, the rare ancient antiquity coins, and maybe I would leave them to him. But then, you know, I don't even have the money anyway. So, but then I was really thinking that even if I had the money, I mean, what is it that I would actually want to give my kid, you know, my son? And I thought the best thing to give him is my full expression about what is really dear to me, what really matters to me, you know, which is A, my spirituality, my faith, my love, my fault. You know, I'm not a perfect person, I have many faults, you know, which is why I repent daily. And you know, there's also, I try and capture this moment sometimes, you know, in some of the records you can hear my son laughing in the background or doing whatever, you know. And I think that's special moments. I'm capturing a moment, you know, I'm putting, you know, I'm worshipping, for me, the living God, you know, the one who sustains me, because it's obviously, it's not neoliberalism that sustains me, or the gold, or the music business, you know. I live by faith, simple as that. And this is what I want to sort of give to my kid, you know, and say, this is me, this is my life, my biography, so to speak. This is maybe an extension of me, and you can learn, he can learn something from it, you know. And I don't want him to sell that. You know, it should be like a part of the family history. Of course, he can license, you know, third parties to like streaming website, like I'm doing, you know. But would I want him to sell it, to sell that catalog to some third party like Scooter Braun for $300 million or $3 million or whatever? I don't think so. That's not my intention at all. You know, I want this my music to remain, you know, in the exclusive, even if it ends $1 or $6, which is peanuts, it should just still remain within my family. You know, I don't want it to be some catalog owned by some big corporation out there that I don't know what is their agenda, you know, that are for profit, you know. I mean, I don't think I would want just pure profit to be the motive and, you know, to be like, this will be the motive, you know, for someone getting my work and trying to exploit it to make money. I mean, I think there's more to my music than trying to exploit it to make money, you know. I don't know how Taylor feels about her music, but, you know, and I don't know how she feels about having 300 million. I mean, I look at the other young lady that she was being managed together with, you know, Angela D'Angelo and Angela Marie D'Angelo. And I don't think she's made a big, you know, I mean, I think, of course, maybe she has probably a normal life and everything, a roof over her head, and she's not a mega star like Taylor Swift, but, you know, I don't know who's happy, Taylor Swift or she, you know, I don't know who's more fulfilled, Taylor Swift or she, you know, but regardless, it's just interesting to see that this thing called the entertainment business, you know, the more I'm studying and reading about it, because I've become a bona fide official professional musician now, something I never imagined. I'm finding myself like, oh, one has to, like, there's this business aspect of the music industry that to me is like, I just want to create my music, you know. And then I realized, no, there's a whole bunch of stuff, you know, to a point where, you know, I've even registered some of my music with the, you know, the U.S. Copyright Office, my handpan music. You know, if you go to the U.S. Copyright Office, you put in handpan, you're going to find some of my stuff there. And I'm, you know, internal registering every aspect of my creative stuff, you know, because I don't want it to get bought and sold is just another commercial product or stock or something, because when I'm making it, you know, that's not my intention, you know. I don't think I want that at all for my music, you know. I don't know how other musicians feel about their art, but I don't think I make my music to make money, but It's a deeply spiritual thing, you know. For me, it's my form of worship, you know. And this business of entertainment is like concerns me and scares me a little bit, because when I see the greed that Taylor Swift was tweeting about, as I said, I don't know the parties involved, you know, I don't know what are the specifics, but we have heard a lot of greed and power, and you know, you suddenly see these young people when they start out in music, you know, when you look at them, they look like normal human beings, but at the end, when they look at them now, you're like, man, how did they transform into this? You know, they don't even look human anymore, act human. It's like, maybe that's the selling your soul part, like you become something else, you know. You like, you become a brand or something, or you just don't, it's like, I don't know, man, is that worth it for 300 million, even for $1 billion, for 3 billion, I mean, would I sell my soul for that? Never, ever, no, that's just me, you know. Anyway, so I think Taylor, in conclusion, I just want to say, I think Taylor Swift has likely suffered many heartbreaks from dealings, you know, with the shoddy companies, and perhaps that explains why there's a lot of, you know, this historical information about the origins of Taylor Swift. Maybe that is shrouded mystery. Maybe Scooter Braun was not the first one. Maybe that was just the one that really hurt the most. But I could imagine she has had a few heartbreaks with some of the management things that were done. I mean, I don't know what role her parents played in that, whether they were also duped into signing away her copyrights. I mean, I don't know. But anyway, this information which I have revealed here, I don't know if it was deliberately swept under the carpet. I don't know. But my investigative search on Taylor Swift has revealed that some of the information on Wikipedia is obviously factually correct and downright wrong. You know, just an example is, it mentions that her years active is from 2003 to present, but let's be honest, I mean, she was performing before Rudy Giuliani, at these Merrill Lynch things, you know, singing national anthems at all these big events, you know, sporting events, and you know, as I mentioned, even Jay-Z was sitting as an audience in one of those. He was watching basketball, not really Taylor Swift. So my archaeological digital dig, and I love to do archaeological digital digs on celebrities, and I don't think this will be my last one, but of course it has to be prompted by something that really speaks to me, you know, because I'm not just doing some celebrity thing, and I'm just in my own journey as a musician, as a handpan musician who gets peanuts from the streaming revenue corporations, you know, it's peanuts. You know, I've, of course, it, at least the peanuts comes my way, but it's still peanuts. It's like you can't even make a payout because the minimum is $10. So, you know, I'm not bragging about my music or whatever. You know, I don't have that kind of audience that Taylor Swift has. But if the key to having that kind of platform, I mean, she has like 140 million followers on Instagram. If the price is that you pay with your soul and with your copyright, yeah, then I don't want those 140 million. You know, I'll be okay with 100 followers or 140 or just one, you know, whatever. No, even if it's me who listen to my music because I like it, you know, I actually wanted to make music that I like, because all my life, you know, music was sort of marketed to me. I remember one of my first music tapes, I mean, of course, I grew up listening to, my father had all these vinyls of Jimi Hendrix and, you know, Chuck Berry and, you know, Nina Simone and all these musicians. But my first real experience as a sort of young teen was a Snoop Dogg, Doggy Style, you know, tape that was given to me. And, you know, I was like into this whole West Coast hip hop and stuff. But looking back, that, you know, is that what I liked or that was just marketed to me? I think that was marketed to me. So I went through a musical detox. I haven't talked about this, but now I'm revealing it. For many years, I think from about, for almost 6 years, you know, I've gone on a musical detox where I threw away everything, a record, whatever, you know, I just stopped listening to music. When I used to like a lot of reggae music as well, I just stopped listening to it. It's like I stopped. Couldn't do it, didn't want it. And I just didn't have music, you know, until I moved out here, you know, in the countryside, you know, and then I wanted to learn one instrument because that was denied me when I was a kid. And I started with a bongo drum, you know, started playing congas. I played a lot of cajons until one day, you know, I managed to get a steel drum, a steel pan, and man, I just fell in love. I donated all my other drums, I mean most of them anyway, to the kindergarten where my kid is going, and now I'm specializing in playing the hand pan. You know, I have the hand pan and the steel tong drum that I'm really, a lot of my music, that's how I'm making, I'm composing, and I think I have the biggest catalog of any independent handpan, I think, of any handpan artist. I'm in, and this will be verified by the world, Guinness World Records, you know. I'm not bragging or anything, but I just really love making handpan music. And unlike most people who just play with their fingers, I use mallets, but I also play with my fingers sometimes. And I play while standing. Most people sit down. You know, I have my own techniques. Nobody has taught me. The Spirit has taught me, the Holy Spirit, to play this instrument, you know, to honor God, the Most High. And I think that's more valuable than 300 million or 300 billion. And of course, if it is God's will and God's will alone, then my music would reach a much bigger, broader audience. Sure, you know, but I'm never going to sell out to some corporation or to the devil and change my messaging, you know, for the sake of, you know, money and fame and stuff like that. Actually, I would want my music listened to by some people, those who really want to, but I don't think I want to be like a center stage famous person, you know. I mean, and have all that attention on me, you know. I'm pretty happy living my life in, you know, having my privacy. And you know, I want to be able to go to the shop and buy bread and nobody pays attention to me, and just I'm just another person walking and going out, you know. I don't want to be having this celebrity thing. I don't think I want to have people screaming my name or screaming at me. I really don't want that, actually. And I just want to make my music, that's it, you know. So, I don't know, you know. I think this music thing is very complicated. But anyway, this was my archaeological dig and revelation exclusive here. And, you know, I did my research using Alexa Crowles, the Wayback Machine. And now we know that Taylor Swift was active from when, you know, as, I mean, really active in the music scene from as far back as 2002. You know, before her debut album, you know, which came out, it was in 2006. She's a prodigy of Atlantic talent management, which somehow seems to have disappeared. I don't know if relations went sour or what happened with that, you know. But there's a lot of history of musicians and corporations, which apparently, according to a lot of the musicians, these corporations take advantage of them. These corporations break their hearts, ruin their lives, and, you know, these corporations are just entities, you know, that were created by men. They were incorporated as if they are human beings, but it's human beings who are controlling them, you know. But they have the power to sue and be sued. They, you know, I come from Africa, and, you know, my country was sold to a corporation. I mean, my country... It was Cecil Rhodes who was given a charter by Queen Victoria through a corporation called the British South African Company, and that corporation hired mercenaries and massacred many people, you know, thousands and thousands of people, and, you know, enslaved my people, colonized my people back in Africa for the sake of making profit for, you know, London, City of London bankers and investors, you know. So we know their names, but I don't have to mention them. But that's part of history, you know. I mean, you can't erase it. History is history. But for the sake of money, my people, my country, everything was sold to the British Cecil Rhodes guy who, you know, dominated Southern Africa. I mean... So I have a very hard time with these corporations because of when I study history and I collect historical documents and I see how these corporations really dealt with people. I mean, they were taxing people, these taxes of, you know, hut tax. You know, people in Africa live in huts. And these people, you know, they the money, I think I calculated the billions that was extorted from these people. They were impoverished, you know, in the 1800s, and people would say, oh, why is Africa poor today, and so on. I mean, this thing was systematically done through corporations, you know, many years ago. So I see corporations, a lot of these corporations, with a long history of exploiting people. They exploit the resources, they exploit, I mean, look at Nigeria. There was a writer they killed who was called Ken Saro-Wiwa, because you were speaking against these very big oil companies. And they killed him, you know. I mean, his family got some compensation from one of these big oil companies. You can read about Ken Saro-Wiwa. It was very tragic how they killed the guy because he dared to stand up to this corporation that was exploiting his people, exploiting their lands, poisoning their lands with all these oil spills. you know, I'm talking in Nigeria, there's corruption through corporations. I mean, the story is similar throughout Africa. And in the music business, you know, I think maybe many of these corporations that own these big catalogs, I think there are a lot of sad stories behind how they came to own those catalogs of all those musicians. And I don't know, maybe they should be given back. I don't know, you know, I guess that's not for me to say, but I have made the choice and the decision, you know, that, and I'm making it public, you know, that my music is not for sale. And I've learned from, you know, reading about some of these musicians, but it wasn't just my own personal decision and choice. Even if I get small money, even if I get big money, whatever money I get, it doesn't matter. But I am not gonna sell my copyright to some corporation. No, no, no. And I sympathize with this young lady. And again, I'm not supporting her art or whatever, you know. I don't know what she's involved in. You know, there's a lot of these musicians doing a lot of weird occult stuff. You know, I haven't really gone into her music. As I said, I'm not a fan. I can't name one of her songs, but I just wanted to talk about these contractual aspects. This is a long podcast, and I think, I don't know if I'll do another follow-up if I find more information, but you know, whoever you are, if you're a musician, you're an actor, you know, you are an artist, yeah, be careful, man, woman, lady, sir, whatever your title is, you know, just please be careful. You know, there's a lot of manipulation in the industry. There's a lot of greed there. People just want to profit off your creativity at your expense. And I don't think, I think musicians should own their copyrights. Thank you. This is Drumcoin. See you in the next episode. And if you want to listen to my music, just put Drumcoin, YouTube, Spotify, Amazon Music. Actually, I think Amazon Music pays me, you know, better rates than Spotify. But whatever you want to listen, you know, if you're on Spotify, Apple, Deezer, Tidal, whatever, you can just put Drumcoin, you'll find my music. And if you like handpan music, please subscribe, follow the thing, and, you know, share with your friends or whatever. If you don't like it, don't listen to it. Thank you. This is Drumcoin.